Chapter 18. Jesus has an advantage on us. He knows when he's going to die. He knows how he's going to die. And he knows why he's going to die. Now, in some ways, those first two might not seem like an advantage. To know when you're going to die might not be an advantage for some of us. Because I don't know if we could live like he lives, knowing when we were going to die. And I especially do not think it would be an advantage to us to know how we were going to die if we knew the how was on a Roman cross, rejected by his own people, crucified, falsely accused, mocked, and ridiculed in extreme anguish, and even separated from his father, at least for a moment on the cross. That doesn't seem like an advantage. But why he's going to die, that would be an advantage, to understand there is purpose with what he is doing and what he's trying to accomplish. But this came to me more this week because Jesus knew the when, especially the when, and the how and the why, he also knew how to take advantage of the time that he has. And so consequently, he filled 3 years of his life with some very purposeful, intentional investing into 12 men, teaching and training and raising them up. And then as we have come to the end of John's gospel, what really hit me was he knew that tomorrow I die. And so consequently, you know, we have gone through chapter 13, chapter 14, chapter 15, chapter 16, chapter 17, and that's what, 5-6 chapters of the Bible. And they're long, and there is a lot there. And they are the last words of Jesus to his disciples on the night before he would die. He got out everything he wanted to say before he was going to go and be with the Father. And I was reminded this week that we don't have that advantage. We don't know when a person is going to die. We don't know when we are going to die. And consequently, when the Spirit of God prompts you to say something, you might want to take advantage of it. Because my best friend called me this week to tell me that my high school cross-country coach had passed away suddenly. At a fairly young age, he was 70. And in this church, he was but a youth. Guys, since my daughter won the state championship 8 years ago, 100 times the Spirit has prompted me to write him a letter and thank him for what he gave to me, not her. He gave something to me that I could give to her. And just to reconnect with him, and I kept putting it off, saying, well, you know what, I'm going to be there, you know, in the following year. And I, in fact, have only been there once since that happened. And I was unable to connect with him because he was gone at the time when I went by his house. And I just kept putting off that letter and putting it off, and then was reminded this week, when the Spirit of God prompts you to do something, don't put it off. If Jesus teaches us anything, he didn't put this off. He didn't put any of this off. He let us know exactly what we needed to know before he is going to be taken up to be with his Father. And John chapter 18 then begins this new section where we can sort of characterize it with several words. First, Jesus is betrayed. Secondly, Jesus is arrested. Third, Jesus is abandoned. Jesus is denied. Jesus is interrogated. Jesus is accused. Jesus is tried. Jesus is convicted. And Jesus is crucified. There's a series of these things that happen to Jesus in the next two chapters, and they just happen one after another. But what John wants you to know through all of these things, Jesus is in control. None of these things happen except for Jesus allows them to happen. He's in control. And that is what he wants you to see in these passages. Though he tells the story, even in his interrogation by Annas or by Pilate, it is very quick that you realize, who's interrogating who here? Who's on trial here? Is this Jesus on trial or is Pilate on trial? Because very quickly it starts to feel like Pilate is on trial, because Jesus is always in control of what is happening in this day and these hours. John 18. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the brook Kidron, where there was a garden which he and his disciples entered. Now Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. So Judas, having procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, went there with lanterns and torches and weapons. And when Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, came forward and said to them, "Whom do you seek?" They answered him, "Jesus of Nazareth." And Jesus said to them, "I am." And Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. And when Jesus said to them, "I am," they drew back and fell to the ground. So he asked them again, "Whom do you seek?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." And Jesus answered, "I told you that I am. So if you seek me, let these men go." This was to fulfill the word that he had spoken, "Of those whom you gave me, I have lost not one." And then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. And the servant's name was Malchus. And so Jesus said to Peter, "Put your sword into its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me?" So the band of soldiers and their captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. And first they led him to Annas, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. And it was Caiaphas who had advised the Jews that it would be expedient that one man should die for the people. It's interesting how John just drops that verse in there just to remind us that Jesus' death had purpose. And he reminds us the first one that recognized its purpose was the unbelieving man who wants him killed, Caiaphas. And Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. And since that disciple was known to the high priest, he entered with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest. But Peter stood outside at the door. So the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the servant girl who kept watch at the door and brought Peter in. And the servant girl at the door said to Peter, You also are not one of this man's disciples, are you? And he said, "I am not." Now the servant and officers had made a charcoal fire because it was cold, and they were standing and warming themselves. And Peter also with them, standing and warming himself. And the high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. Let's stop there for now and look at sort of three major things that we can apply to our lives and learn from. The first one has to do with his arrest, maybe even his betrayal. We'll touch on each of these points, but I really want to focus in on his arrest, because I think that we can learn some things about the whole story of Jesus' crucifixion from just details that we are given in the arrest. But let's begin with, when Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the brook Kidron. The word brook there is actually, what I don't know why we don't translate it this way, it's a wadi. At certain times of the year, there's water running in it, and other times of the year, it's like the rivers in Tucson. And I'm always in Tucson when it's dry, so I'm wondering what's the need for all of these bridges? Because I can't fathom, why did you waste your time building all of these bridges? Well, I've never been there when it rains. And when it rains, those things become gushing rivers. And the Kidron is like that. But here it's in the dry season, so they had no problem crossing it. They're walking across on dry ground. And they work their way out to a garden. This garden is not like our kinds of gardens. Remember, it's on the side of the Mount of Olives. The Mount of Olives is called the Mount of Olives for a reason. It's because it grows olive trees on the sides of it. And this garden is an olive garden, an olive tree garden. And we know that merely because of its name, Gethsemane. Gethsemane is the word for olive press. It's the instrument in which they use to get the olive oil from the olives. That's the word, Gethsemane. So we know this was a garden of olive trees that somebody was farming. It's not a normal kind of, it's more of a, this is their orchard, right? And we also know that there was probably a wall around that garden. We know that because of the way, the word that they used, that Jesus went into it and out of it. That would imply that there was a wall and a gate that he had to go into. It was owned by somebody. It wasn't some public garden that they gathered in. It was a privately owned place by some individual. And it is clear that Jesus and his disciples, this is not the first time they've been there. They've been there many times. Apparently, this garden has been made available to them on a regular basis. What might that tell you about the owner of that garden? He was most likely a disciple of Jesus. But it would tell you other things. It would tell you, guys, if you own land on the side of the Mount of Olives, just outside of Jerusalem, you are rich, rich, rich. Especially in the first century. Because that was the most coveted land in all of the world. Because that's where Israel's kings were buried. And that's where every Jew wanted to be buried. They all wanted to be buried on that hillside outside of Jerusalem. It would not surprise me if that garden actually had a tomb in it. And if it does have a tomb in it, in fact, if you went to Jerusalem today, you'll have a couple spots of the Lord's tomb. One of them is suggested that it's in the Garden of Gethsemane. I wouldn't be surprised, because then I could understand, now I know who that disciple is. And I'm quite aware of the fact that he's quite wealthy, right? His name is Joseph of Arimathea, and he is a very, very wealthy man. How do you know that? 75 pounds of spices and myrrh is expensive. That is a very expensive thing that he wrapped. Thank you. My wife wasn't here to do it, and Jamie came through. That is a lot of money to spend on wrapping a body up. But Joseph was a wealthy man. And I know you guys don't like it when I speculate, but I also think that Joseph is who? There's another Joseph in the Bible, but we never hear his name. We just hear a different name. His name is Barnabas, the son of encouragement. And I think Joseph of Arimathea is actually Barnabas, because Barnabas is named his Joseph, and he is a Levite. And Joseph of Arimathea was one of the Levitical families in Jerusalem in the Sanhedrin, and a very wealthy man. And what did Barnabas do? What is he famous for doing the first time we see him in the book of Acts? He sold a plot of ground and laid the money at the disciples' feet. Just speculating, but I think he sold that plot of ground. That plot of ground that Jesus was buried on. Partly because he knew, we got to get rid of this before people make a shrine of it. Now that is a guess, but certainly a well-known disciple of Jesus owned this property. And Jesus and his disciples gathered there on a regular basis, which explains why Judas knew to find them there. However, we need another little historical detail to know why Judas would have found them there. Because every day that week, that is not where Jesus and his disciples spent the night. Where did they spend the night that week? They went all the way up to Bethany and spent the night probably at Lazarus's and Mary and Martha's home. We know that from John's gospel. We know it from the other gospels that they would go each night and travel, and it's 2 miles. up to Bethany, and they would spend the night there, away from the crowds, in a relative safety, if you can call it that, from the problems brewing in Jerusalem. So why would Judas assume that they're in the garden? Why would he not go and take these guards to Bethany, where they had stayed every single night that week? Well, because Judas knew they wouldn't be there. And why is that? Well, because on the Passover feast, if you left the city by more than maybe about a fifth or a quarter of a mile, you are not allowed to participate in the Passover festival that day. You couldn't come in from 2 miles because they saw it kind of like a Sabbath. You could only travel so far on a Sabbath. So you could, if they would have gone up to Bethany that evening, they would not have been allowed back into Jerusalem. So consequently, interestingly, the Garden of Gethsemane is within that restrictive zone that you could leave the city and have some privacy, but you are still close enough that you could come back into the city and participate in that festivity. I think Judas knew that. I think Judas knew that, well, they won't be going to Bethany, so where are they going to stay? Maybe he took them by the house. See, we're never told this, but maybe he took them by the house where the upper room was, and there was no one there. And so consequently, where are they going to be? Where would Jesus have gone? Oh, I know where he went. He went to the Garden of Gethsemane. That makes perfect sense. And here comes Judas marching out of Jerusalem. And he's marching out in verse 2. Now Judas, who betrayed him. We probably shouldn't just pass over that. This is not just a friend betraying a friend. This is a man who was in the boat with Jesus when the waters were rushing in, and like all the rest of the disciples, thought for sure he was going to drown. And Jesus sat up and went, shh. And the winds and the waves went still in a, not even a second, in the twinkling of an eye, it was dead calm. Judas was there. And he experienced that. Judas was there and probably paying very close attention when 15,000 people, 5,000 men, 10,000 women and children are being fed by one little boy's lunch. And knowing how much Judas likes money, I suspect that he was over there with a calculator thinking, we need to open a restaurant, right? If we can feed 15,000 people with two fish and five loaves, we can make a killing. There's no overhead here. See, he's all about the money. But the point is, do you not think he was noticing? Do you not think Judas was recognizing? Is that man ever going to stop having food come out of his hands? Judas was there from the beginning all the way to the end. He saw everything. He saw dead people. He was there. I think it was in the city of Cana. The widow of Nain, the city of Nain. He was there when they were coming into town, and they're hauling this boy out on the pauler, and Jesus stops them and commands him, and he comes to life. That's the man who betrayed Jesus. That's almost incomprehensible. It's almost incomprehensible that this person would reject Jesus after experiencing so many things. And why is he rejecting him? Why is he betraying him? Well, I think Judas thinks he's doing Jesus a favor, but the point is, Judas is unwilling to embrace the Messiah Jesus is. He is only willing to embrace the Messiah he wants Jesus to be. And even though Jesus has revealed these wondrous things to him, it has not changed the heart of Judas. He wants Jesus to be the Messiah he wants him to be. Guys, there's application there. Many people want God to be the kind of God they want him to be. And God may come and reveal himself in wondrous ways in their life, and they're like, wow. Now, none of us are probably going to get the experiences Judas got, and certainly the undeniable experiences that Judas has. But Judas reminds us that if he can betray Jesus, if he can reject Jesus, anybody can. The idea that, well, if God would just come down and do some spectacular miracles for me, I would believe in him. That is actually a nonsensical view. Judas saw all of that for 3 years. But he would not let go of who he thought God should be, the Messiah should be. When God revealed to him through his son, that's not who he is and that's not who he's going to be. And I think there are people in this world that are the same. That they believe in a God, but they believe in a God of their own imagination and their own creation. And when they discover through the revelation of Jesus, that's not who I am, that's not what I'm about, they will reject God before following him. They will betray him. They will deny him. They will pretend that that God doesn't exist and that their God continues to exist. And this is why we should not just read right over, now Judas betrayed him. Because it is remarkable that one so close and who had had so many experiences betrayed Jesus. He also knew the place because he'd been there many times. For Jesus often met there with his disciples. So Judas, having procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, went there with lanterns and torches and weapons. And then Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, and that's John's theme, Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, knew that Judas was coming to arrest him. And instead of waiting in the garden, buying every little minute, Jesus walked out of that garden towards the city of Jerusalem and faced death head on. He walked out and met them. And this is the picture John wants us to see of Jesus. It was the picture that probably impressed upon probably the youngest disciple of all of them. Probably not even out of his teen years yet, was John. Watching Jesus boldly, unafraid, lead them out of that garden and heading straight towards a mob coming towards them. And that's the impression Jesus left on John. Whom do you seek? And they answered, Jesus of Nazareth. And Jesus said to them, and I know our Bible says, I am he. Guys, it's just ego a me. I am. Now, I understand that phrase can be translated, I am he, most of the time. And you might say this would be an appropriate time to translate it that way. But it is clear from what happens next that this is not so much Jesus saying, I'm the one you're looking for. This is Jesus saying, I am. In other words, he's challenging their designation of him. Who do you seek? Jesus, the Son of God? No. Jesus, the Son of David? No. Right? Jesus, the Messiah? No. Who do they seek? Jesus of Nazareth. Oh, that's just a guy. Jesus of Nazareth is just a guy. A guy born of a carpenter, you know, out of wedlock with his wife Mary, who's from Nazareth. He's just a guy. And Jesus will not give them that. I am. I don't know if you seek me, but I am. Am I the one you're seeking? And there's almost incredible irony going on here because of the word seek and Jesus using the divine name from the Old Testament, I am. That is the name that God gives Moses. When Moses says, who shall I tell them is sending me? You go and tell them I am is sending you. And so Jesus uses that name, I am. Are you seeking I am? Or are you seeking Jesus of Nazareth? Because if you're seeking I am, there's going to be a lot different outcome to this encounter than if you're seeking Jesus of Nazareth. Too many people in this world, they're seeking Jesus of Nazareth. But Jesus is I am. And so he, in this irony, he responds. And what happens? And we've talked about this a couple times, and we'll talk about it one more time because I got more to tell you about it. And when Jesus said to them, I am, they drew back and fell to the ground. There's an important detail in this little section of the arrest that tells us a lot about the entire trial. Things that we're not told in the text itself that we know had to have happened. And actually then makes sense of all kinds of details that the Bible does have because we didn't realize something has already occurred. Judas procured a band of soldiers. That band of soldiers is the word cohort. A cohort is a Roman term describing Roman soldiers. Some of your Bibles actually translate it Roman soldiers. This is very important that Judas didn't just come with the temple guard to arrest Jesus. He got a cohort of Roman soldiers to come with him. Now, there's reasons on both sides. One reason might be, if you will remember even from John's gospel, but certainly the other gospels, this is not the first time they've tried to arrest Jesus, right? At least two other times they have sent the guards from the temple to arrest Jesus. The first time they sent the guards, they got there and Jesus was doing something spectacular. And then he was teaching and the guards literally forgot why they had come. Remember, they come back to the temple talking about Jesus and like, where's Jesus? Oh yeah, that's right. We were supposed to arrest him. But they were so caught up in what Jesus was doing, they forgot. Probably with a little help from the Holy Spirit. And boy, were the temple authorities angry. So about 3 or 4 months later, they sent him again to arrest Jesus. And this time they remembered what they're supposed to be doing, but somehow they couldn't move their arms because Jesus just walked right through the midst of them and left. And they stood there wondering, weren't we here to do something? We're supposed to be doing something. Now, is it surprising then to you that the third time that the temple authorities are sending someone to arrest Jesus, they decide, okay, we cannot just send these guards. Guys, they're the same guys. They've already failed twice, so they're going to make doubly sure that Jesus gets arrested. So they sent, we're going to get Roman soldiers to do this because these guys are the professionals. They are trained. And so this time Judas procures, through the help, I'm sure, of the temple, a cohort of Roman soldiers. Let me explain something about first century Israel. I don't care if you're Caiaphas, you do not give orders to Roman soldiers. No Jew tells a cohort of Roman soldiers what they're going to do. There are only two individuals that can tell the Roman soldiers what they're going to do. The one is Achilliarch. He is the commander of those soldiers. And the other is Pilate. And consequently, in a situation like this, we learn something here because of the presence of the Roman soldiers. This was not just something that happened all of a sudden. Pilate was absolutely aware of what was going on. Pilate had to send these soldiers. There's no way they would have gone with Judas unless Pilate had sent them. Consequently, we know some things. That the high priest and the Jewish leadership had already gone to Pilate and had brought their case against Jesus before Pilate and asked for his assistance in arresting Jesus. We know that. We also then can figure out details later on why Jesus says what he says to Pilate and why Pilate says what he says to Jesus. We actually know what their accusation was against Jesus. You see, the religious leaders, the Sadducees and the Pharisees, the problem that they had with Jesus was this, that not that he claimed to be Israel's king. They weren't going to have a problem with someone saying that they're the Messiah. They had a problem with someone saying they're a Messiah but not acting like a Messiah. They had a problem with saying that he is the Son of God in a way that the Messiah is not. That he had a relationship with Yahweh and the Father. And in fact, finally, Jesus comes out and says, before Abraham was, I am. He is claiming that this relationship is such that he can claim the name of God. That's the problem they had with him. Guys, that's a theological problem. Do you think Pilate cares? He didn't care one bit about that. And they knew that. They're not going to get Pilate to go along with them to arrest Jesus if that's their accusation against him. That's their problem. So what did they do? Hey, there's a guy here, and he is pretending to be Israel's king. And he's stirring up the people. And a king A person who thinks he's the king of Israel and stirring up the people is a threat to Rome. You need to do something about him, Pilate. There is a dangerous king out there, and he is a danger to Rome. And they persuaded Pilate of that. So Pilate says, okay, yep, we do need it. And this explains something. If Pilate thinks that Jesus is an insurrectionist and a king, a person claiming to be king, and he has these massive crowds, because I'm sure Pilate has heard, did you see all the people that came out when Jesus came into Jerusalem? If that's how Pilate is seeing Jesus, then it is no wonder he sent a cohort of soldiers. Because a cohort of soldiers is 720 infantry and 740 infantry and 260 cavalry. 1,000 men. Now, we figure around 600. We know pretty much what the size of this group is because this cohort is normally not in Jerusalem. They are kept in the it's like a fortress in Caesarea Philippi. But on days of the feast, the high feast days, Passover, you know, the Feast of Tabernacles, there's four feasts during the year, they would move that cohort of soldiers to Jerusalem. So we know how many. There was at least 600 men, infantrymen, not counting the horse soldiers. Guys, remember when, I mean, you think somebody in my class or in at the hospital this week when I was saying this just stopped me and said, how do you know all of this? Well, part of it is just reading. You actually can just pick it up from other texts. Remember when Paul was arrested? And when they not when he was arrested, but when they sort of did arrest him, and the Jews wanted to kill him, and they wanted to get Paul out of town. How many soldiers did they have there? They had this cavalry that led him out. Guys, that's the cavalry portion of the cohort. And it was like 170 men on horses escorted him because they wouldn't have used them all. They'd have kept some there in case they needed them. But like 100 or 170 men escort Paul down to Caesarea Philippi. There are ways to know these things just by reading the Bible, let alone just knowing Roman history. But I want you to see it, guys. It's not just that there were a minimum 600, 700 soldiers that went out with Judas to arrest Jesus. Because Pilate's thinking, insurrectionist, I'm going to put this down. They're Roman soldiers. Do you guys know what Roman soldiers are famous for? Do you know how they fight? What made the Roman army famous was they fought in formation. They would line their shields up, and they would have these short swords, shield to shield to shield. In fact, I was watching one of the Hobbit movies last night. They have the five battles, and it's like, you're stealing this from the Roman soldiers, both the elves and the dwarves. And the shields are lined up right next to each other, and they have that short sword. But there's another part of their fighting. And guess where the next line is? Right behind that line. And right, if there is one thing a Roman soldier knows how to do, he knows how to stand. Because Roman soldiers are trained in battle to withstand anything attacking them. War horses coming at them, they're trained to stand. And the way they stand is that first row, they're up there, but they're being supported by a row behind them. And that row is being supported by a row behind them. And that row is being supported by a row behind them. So that when a horse or even other larger animals used in battle come crashing into them, they don't move. Think about that. Whole armies have been broken. In fact, if you read about Roman history, the armies of the world were broken upon attacking that front line of Roman soldiers because they were immovable. Everybody knows that, except for people reading in the 21st century. But everybody in the first century knows what makes a Roman soldier famous? The way they fight. They're an immovable force. I am. And what happened? Well, that immovable force found out they could be moved. And that's why God did this. It's not just trying to impress us. He wanted those Roman soldiers to know, you cannot take my son. He may only lay his life down. And 700 Roman soldiers fall down. That would be the first time in their life they've ever fallen down going into battle. It must have been incomprehensible. How did this happen? The man merely said, "I am," and they fell down. Wow. What is John trying to get across to us? Well, he's definitely trying to get across to us this. "This is my son in whom I am well pleased." He is not Jesus of Nazareth. He is Jesus, the Son of God, that you have come to arrest. And you need to understand, there is no arrest going on here unless he so chooses. And there will be no crucifixion unless he so chooses. And it starts right in the beginning. They fall down. And John wants us to know something. And Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place. But look at verse 3. "He procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests. And then, knowing all that would happen to him, Jesus came forward. 'Whom do you seek?' 'Jesus of Nazareth.' 'I am he.'" But notice what he says right before he tells us that they all fell down, because he wants you to see it. "And Judas was standing with them." You think that's an accident? Because he's just about to tell us that everybody in this crowd is going to fall down. And he wants you to know everybody, including Judas. Judas was standing with him. I say this because there's an application here, and we're already running out of time. I haven't got to my second point. Man, is God merciful and gracious. Wouldn't you think by now God would cease trying to reach Judas with his grace and his mercy? I mean, he's made up his mind, right? And we've already been told that he's fulfilling Scripture. But it seems as if John wants us to know, because, you know, John is that gospel, you know, that disciple of love kind of guy. If you're going to betray Jesus and you bring, and you're standing there and you along with them find yourself on the ground, shouldn't that have been a sufficient message to Judas? You chose the wrong side. Jesus and his 12 disciples are standing in front of you. You've procured 600-700 Roman soldiers and you're laying flat on your back with them. Shouldn't that have said to Judas, "Jesus, forgive me. What am I doing? I remember you. I don't know how I forgot. I was there when you walked on the water. I was there when you fed the 5,000, the 15,000. I was there when you hushed the seas and the waves." Wouldn't this bring that to his mind? "I was there when you walked through the crowd at Nazareth and they couldn't touch you. And I was there when you walked through these guards here. That's why I brought these soldiers. I thought it could be different this time. I brought 600 Roman soldiers. Surely it would be different this time." But it isn't any different. Because I was there every time when you demonstrated you were more than just a man. What in the world am I doing here? That should have been the response of Judas, but it wasn't. He picked himself off the ground with the Roman soldiers. And Jesus said, who are you seeking? "Jesus of Nazareth." Maybe that's an acceptable answer from the Romans, from the chief priests. It isn't really even acceptable from them. But I'll tell you this, that is not an acceptable answer from Judas Iscariot. "Who are you seeking, Judas? Jesus of Nazareth? Is that who you're seeking? Come on, Judas. You know I'm way more than that." But that's what he said. And Jesus said, "I am." One last time for Judas's benefit, and then he said, he gives them permission. Some would say he commands them. Jesus answered in verse 8, "I told you that I am he, so if you seek me, let these men go." Let sounds like he's asking for permission, but that actually is a Greek phrase. It's called the cohortative. It is actually a third-person command. They use let differently than we do. When he says let them go, he's actually commanding them. You will let them go. That's what he's really saying. Jesus is saying, "I'm he, and I'm willing to go with you, but you will let them go." I mean, just to make the emphasis, John tells us about Peter now running forward, drawing his sword, and cutting off one of the guy's ears. And we've talked about the incompetence. He cuts off the right ear. Or yes, the left ear, right? No, he cuts off the right ear. Well, if Peter's like most people is right-handed, that's one lousy shot. It's hard to cut off a man's left ear with your right arm. But he's a fisherman, and he doesn't even know what he's doing. But what I think John really wants you to see is, and these 600, 700 Roman soldiers and all the guards from the temple, let them go. Can you really imagine that if Pilate had sent a cohort of soldiers out there to arrest Jesus and put down a rebellion, that they're going to let his 12 closest disciples go? Guys, that's never going to happen. Why would they do such a thing? There's only one explanation. Because Jesus commanded them to do it. You will let them go, or you will not take me in. That's some power, guys. And why would a Roman soldier listen to this man? Because they're flat on their backs. And they've never been flat on their backs. And in that moment, they knew they were dealing with something they couldn't control. So consequently, they took the deal and they let the disciples go. And Jesus was abandoned. Oh, there's more to say. And we will wait till next week. More application, especially why Jesus commanded to let them go. But we'll have to come back in a couple weeks and pick that up. And these poor men are all going to be at a men's retreat, so they'll miss out. So some of the wives of those men can tell them what they missed. But it is amazing what Jesus does for us. I'll give you a hint. Guys, he promised to keep us. He promised to guard us. He promised not to lose us. Jesus knew that if these men were arrested with him, they would have done more than abandon him. They would have done more than deny him. They would have renounced him. They would not, their faith, because the Holy Spirit was not in them yet, their faith would not have withheld what Jesus was about to go through. And here's the good news. God will never allow you to be tempted beyond what he gives you the strength to resist, because he has promised to keep us and guard us. So if there is something out there that can cause you to lose your faith, God isn't going to let you experience it. If he has to, he'll stand up and make a command. Let these men go. Makes you think of Moses' words to Pharaoh, doesn't it? Let my people go. Guys, that was a command, just as this was. Let's pray. Thank you.